You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. This is Felicia King. You are listening to Breakfast Bites. The topic of the show today has to do with the disturbing reality that is guest Wi-Fi. I've heard from a lot of people lately that they are just absolutely concerned with how is it that they can use guest wireless anywheres and have any level of security. And there are actually options for that, but it's not simple. So let's talk through what those strategies are as well as the problem. But I'm going to first define the problem. And the best way to do that is to actually talk about dark hotel, which happens to be a type of attack that went on for years and years in a bunch of hotels. And it's actually very exemplary of all kinds of wireless, guest wireless type of attacks. There's really, if you understand dark hotel, then I think you can understand virtually every other type of guest wireless type of attack out there. And then understand also that the same risk mitigation methods apply for both. So let's first talk through what the heck is dark hotel. And by the way, if you actually want to see a detailed article on dark hotel, Kaspersky wrote up a really nice article on it, and I do have a link to that article included in the webpage for this podcast, which you can find on qualityplusconsulting.com. So let's first start with dark hotel. The way that it works is you are a visitor at the hotel and you see that they have free wireless. So you connect your device to their free wireless. And usually there will be some sort of a disclaimer page or some sort of a login piece. And sometimes it actually even ties down to something as specific as your last name and your room number. You might even get some sort of a login ID that's as specific as that. But because this is really completely unfettered, unmonitored, free, open Wi-Fi, what has actually happened is that nobody's monitoring it. Nobody knows that there's nasty stuff already been implanted into the Wi-Fi itself, whether it be through a device that's sitting there in terms of a man-in-the-side attack or a man-in-the-middle attack, or if it's actually that the master Wi-Fi device on the back end has actually been compromised and hacked itself and had a Trojan installed in it that then infects your computer. Now, the way that it looks to you usually consists of an update that's presented to you. You get on this wireless and then you start browsing the internet and it says, hey, you need the new version of Adobe Flash. You don't have the latest and greatest version of Adobe Flash. Well, I can tell you that even the vast majority of IT people don't seem to be savvy enough to miss this, to avoid this particular attack, unless they have the discipline that says, and you can have this discipline too, that says, I don't install anything from any website other than the actual software vendor's website, and I am sure as heck not going to be installing anything that prompts me to install while I'm connected to some guest wireless network, because all kinds of funny business could be going there. So it's a matter of you need to be very suspicious and have this discipline and say, I think at my IT department, they use systems management software. So they'll be deploying that update. I shouldn't be doing that. Of course, as an end user, you shouldn't even have the rights to actually install this software update yourself. If the computer is set up correctly, you will be browsing the internet as a non-administrative account. And if you are actually an admin on your computer with an alternate credential, then you would have to go through the process of actually putting in that username and password to privilege escalate to another account. note that I'm drawing a distinction here between simple privilege escalation with basic levels of UAC, which is user account control, versus, oh no, you've got to actually privilege escalate and supply a different account and password. So imagine on an account you have a Bob login ID, and then you have a Bob admin account. See, two totally different accounts. So back to Dark Hotel, again, being an example of the way that these things typically happen. There's a software update that's offered to you. You choose to install it. Now you have actually implanted a full remote access Trojan backdoor command and control keystroke logger, screen capture logger, FTP upload download tool on your machine. You've just been owned. And you don't even know it. So the first thing that this thing is going to do is start scraping all of the browsers that you have installed and looking for cached passwords. Now, you yourself can actually audit your own system to look for cached passwords. You can go to nursoft.net, and yes, you should send a nice little thank you note to NurseOfer for writing some very wonderful tools. NurseOfer at nursoft.net has written wonderful tools for Internet Explorer, Firefox, and I think he's got one for Chrome as well, that give you the ability to look at what the cached passwords are for that are stored in your web browsers, and then kill them. You know, just eliminate them. You should not be caching passwords in a web browser. I mean, that is just straight crazy talk. There is no barrier between access to those cached passwords unless you aren't storing them there. I mean, if something gets on your computer, well, it's now just got all of the cached passwords if you have chosen to cache. So I tend to prefer to just disable password caching straight up in all browsers. And then you can, I mean, you're saying, well, but I want the convenience. Well, then go buy a license of LastPass and plug that into your browser, okay? Do it that way. But then you have to also be disciplined in how you're using LastPass, and you have to actually use a credential set in order to open LastPass, and you can't be having it do auto login, okay? So this, you still have to use the tool intelligently. So this thing gets on your computer. It scrapes all the browsers for cached passwords. It steals all those credentials. It starts uploading them to its command and control server. It downloads a new version of its own remote access Trojan, because of course there's software updates to the remote access Trojan. It installs that keystroke logger, screen capture device, and it starts looking for your data files and stealing them and uploading them. Now, none of this would have actually happened if, one, you didn't install this fake patch, or two, you didn't have the credentials to be able to install the fake patch, or three, if you didn't have sensitive things on this endpoint. Now, that's a very significant piece, and I'm going to get into that some more now. So we're talking about risk mitigation strategies with Guest Wireless. So what can you actually do to deal with it? We've already talked about don't browse the internet as an administrative account. I've said this for, I feel like I've been talking about this for 25 years. Don't browse the internet as an administrative account. Don't do your email as an administrative account. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have a separate account on your computer that is an admin account so that you can do the occasional appropriate privilege escalation that you need to do. That's fine. But if you have a corporate device, then you're not going to have those credentials. Then you need to be contacting your IT department in order to get things installed. And of course, your IT department should have systems management software where they are actually deploying patches for things like Flash and Java, Shockwave, etc. So you shouldn't actually have to worry about software updates. They should be handling that. So don't browse the internet as an administrative account. definitely do not cache passwords in browsers. Use something like LastPass or PasswordSafe. Especially use PasswordSafe with a YubiKey. Big, big, big deal there. In a situation where you're using PasswordSafe, if you have allowed a nasty thing to get on your computer, it's going to grab your PasswordSafe file, and it's going to keystroke log the password that you used to open the PasswordSafe, and now you've just given them all of your passwords. Because the bad guys are going to download your PasswordSafe file and open it and unlock it. The only thing standing in that way is for you to use two-factor authentication, like a YubiKey. Well, that brings up another interesting point. Well, why not just use two-factor authentication with everything that's based upon some sort of a physical token or a physical HASP or something like Phone Factor? Well, gee, you should! Yes, absolutely you should! If you're not using two-factor authentication with LinkedIn and Facebook and your Gmail and, frankly, anything, your Office 365 account, then you're really just, you're missing out. Furthermore, your Office 365, you should probably have an Azure tenant, and it should allow you to do Azure Active Directory synchronization, and you should have two-factor authentication enabled there as well. And then you can do something like linking the access to Facebook and LinkedIn, etc., into your Office 365 account. Now, I caution you, though, that if you're not going to turn on two-factor authentication, you're now crazy to do that. Because at least you formerly had 30 different accounts and 30 different passwords. But if you link all of these other things into your Office 365 account, and then you don't turn on two-factor authentication, well, now you've just given out the keys to the kingdom. Now, on the positive side, both Gmail, Office 365, and most of these other ones, they actually have a variety of ways in which you can do two-factor authentication. My preference, I see actual benefits for using Office 365 integration because there are some sites whose two-factor authentication really just sucks. LinkedIn is a good example of that. They have one method and one method only for two-factor authentication, where their authentication database is the authentication mechanism. And that is texting. So if you have texting disabled on your phone, or if you don't think that a text message is secure, because it's not, then that is a two-factor authentication. Well, that's not really an answer. I would actually much rather take my LinkedIn account and tie that into an Office 365 account and utilize OAuth, which is a form of two-factor authentication, with Office 365. Now, maybe I do that with Phone Factor, maybe I do that with a YubiKey, maybe I do that with a variety of different methods. But because I've now linked my LinkedIn account to an Office 365 tenant, and I have two-factor authentication turned on the tenant, I've now basically short-circuited the weakness in the two-factor authentication at LinkedIn. So, going back to this risk mitigation strategy, obviously I understand that that's a little complex for a lot of you, but that was really, that little piece there was for most of the IT managers out there. So if we move past this thing about the passwords, the next piece I've got for you that's on a risk mitigation strategy is training. Yes, train your people, especially executives. Train them to never, ever, ever install any software. Especially don't install things that look like updates, unless they really, and I mean really, really, really know what they're doing, and unless it's really coming from the correct source. It was a few months ago I was on the phone with a a client who said, well, every time I go to my game website, then it tells me that I need to install a new version of Flash. And I'm like, that website is hacked. You have the latest version of Flash. Let's look at your computer. Sure enough, there's the latest version of Flash. Why is this website prompting you? It's prompting you because it's trying to get you to install malware. I had another client who freaked out where they claimed that they couldn't get to weather.com because weather.com was claiming that they didn't have the latest version of Flash to be able to look at their animated radar or whatever. And I'm like, well, guess what? Your computer has the latest version of Flash. It's a good thing I don't give you admin access to your computer because you would have just destroyed it. So when your IT people have turned off your ability to install software, you need to understand that they're doing it for your own protection. For workstations that are part of a systems management infrastructure, you have to understand that your IT people are inventorying software versions. They are deploying those software updates to your endpoint as quickly as possible. And that when you see something that's talking about, here's this software update that's available, and ooh, scary, scary, I need you to install this now, well, that may just be malware. Now, I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't take a screenshot of that message and send it to your IT people. Absolutely. Go ahead and do that. Send them an email. Say, hey, I just got this message on my computer. I was at this website, and it wants me to install a Flash update. Or down in my system tray, I'm seeing this little icon for a Java update. What should I do? By all means, IT people want to know, especially if you can give us a screenshot. We want to know what's going on with your system. Because if you see this message and it's malicious, then we want to know that this thing is going on so that we can tell other people, hey, there's this malicious stuff on this website. It's hacked right now. Don't go there. The other piece is, what if actually the update is legitimate? What if it is a legitimate Java update? Then we would know, the systems management software is not actually doing what it's supposed to be doing, or whoever is supposed to be driving the systems management software is not getting to the problem resolution as quickly as they should be. Right? So that feedback mechanism is great, and if you have IT people that don't want your feedback mechanism when you are a paid subscriber to their service effectively, then that's not cool. But really, you should do some screenshots. Now, on qualityplusconsulting.com, there is an article that talks about how to make screenshots. So if you have any questions about how that works, go check out that article. Now, the next thing you can do is utilize UEFI instead of BIOS. So you probably heard of BIOS before. A lot of you may not have heard of UEFI. But basically, BIOS is the old legacy boot system. Now there's this thing called UEFI. It's great. Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 require it because Windows 8 and Windows 8.1, certainly Windows 10, they are going secure out of the box. But then you need to actually turn on Secure Boot, and you need to turn on TPM, which is the Trusted Platform Module Infrastructure. Once you turn on Secure Boot and TPM, there's an awful lot of naughty things that just will not be able to install on your system. This is a good thing. So if you went to Best Buy and you bought yourself a computer, make sure it's got UEFI turned on, Secure Boot, and TPM. If you are an IT person, well, then you should be making sure that all of your new systems that you buy come with Windows 8.1, that you are verifying that Secure Boot and TPM are on. And if you're not buying computers with TPM integration, then I don't think you're buying the right equipment. You should be buying equipment with TPM. Another kind of I'm going to get kind of into some more easy ways to do this risk mitigation strategy, though, because I know a lot of these things are rather complex. What if you just had a smartphone with a data plan and you turned your phone on for a hotspot? Well, I suppose you could make an argument that the cellular data provider's network is, you know, slightly more secure than the guest wireless. Yeah, I think you could make that argument. It's certainly not less secure than a guest wireless, unless, of course, the guest wireless is one that is controlled by a competent IT department with appropriate layered defense strategies in place. Because I can tell you that the, like, Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile and so forth, they are not filtering their wireless, their cellular data connections for, you know, security-based things the same way as a really properly well-done guest wireless could do. And really, it's not their job to do that, so they shouldn't be doing that. But if you just wanted to avoid the guest wireless thing, you could certainly use your cellular data plan and then hook up your endpoint, like your tablet or your laptop, to your hotspot on your phone. That's one way to do it as well. Now let's take that a little bit further. Really, the best way to handle all of these things is to say that this endpoint is nothing other than a remote control device of my real workstation, which is in some sort of a virtual desktop infrastructure that I access over remote desktop services. Now, maybe I do this with Direct Connect. Maybe I do it with a VPN that forces all of the traffic to the internet and everywhere else through the VPN tunnel once the VPN tunnel is connected. And then, of course, that VPN tunnel traffic is now, all everything that's happening there is now being filtered through the deep filtering structure of the corporate network. And you know, this doesn't have to be the corporate network as well. I mean, if you've got a small church office with 5 to 10 staff, you can actually have the same level of security, and no, it doesn't have to be astronomically expensive. So you should understand that even, you know, really good security is still accessible to you even in a very, very, very small office. And when you think about five users, a 5 to 10 user small church, and I'm talking about office staff, well, that's really kind of the same thing as you at home, isn't it? So you can get this sort of security at home. You just have to buy the right equipment and have it set up correctly. And the biggest issue that most people face is they don't know how to do these things themselves. And part of what I try to do with this show is to teach you those things. But also part of it is that if you're going to actually take security seriously, then you're probably going to end up having to pay either you're going to have to go get a whole lot of training and choose to take the bull by the horns and learn how to do this yourself, or you're going to have to pay a consultant to teach you how to do these things, and then you partner with that consultant over a period of time. So again, one major strategy is to just treat the endpoint that you carry around with you not as a store of data, not as your primary system, but as nothing other than a remote access tool to get to your real device, which is as part of RDS or VDI, virtual desktop, effectively. Now, if what you're only doing with this endpoint is all you're doing is maybe doing that branch office VP or that VPN tunnel or Direct Connect, and you're getting back into your remote desktop, and everything that you're doing is on the remote desktop, well, now that remote desktop is effectively in a controlled environment. And the only thing that's coming back across the wire to you in your remote location, wherever you are, is mouse movements and keyboard movements and the screen display. So it's definitely true that a keystroke logger would still be grabbing your keystrokes, because your keystrokes then are being forwarded. They're actually happening local, and they're being forwarded to the remote desktop session. Yes, that's true. And certainly screen capture would still happen in that. But there are ways to lock down the remote desktop to where file transfer is not capable that way. So this would stop the malware from being able to literally scrape your machine for stored passwords, to scrape your machine for interesting data files, and then to start uploading those. So I think this is a really simple tactic that's yet very, very effective. But it presumes that you've got some sort of an infrastructure in place where you can keep this remote desktop system secure and protected. So secure means you're patching it properly, you have some sort of a systems management strategy in place. Protected means you have defense in depth, so you have a perimeter device that provides adequate protection, as well as host-based security product that provides adequate protection. And you're still not browsing the internet as an admin account. So Trend has a nice product called Complete User Protection Suite, and it's appropriate, I think, for organizations that have about 100 users or more. And I really like it because it extends the full defense in depth threat protection to the endpoint, rather than like Trend Worry-Free Business Security Services is really good in that middle space of 2 users to 100 users. It's really, really good in that space. The only thing that Worry-Free Business Security Services doesn't do is it can't do APT, DLP, and a lot of the high-end sophisticated things that your perimeter security appliance can do. It can't do that from a software perspective. But the complete endpoint protection can do that. Now, WatchGuard also has a phenomenal article that they put out with regards to ways that you can deal with some of these wireless issues. And I've got a link to that as part of this podcast. If you go to qualityplusconsulting.com and you go to podcast Breakfast Bites, you will see a link to that article posted with this show. And I'm going to draw your attention to a couple of very interesting things in that article. They said 71% of guest networks do not provide unique, temporary, wireless passwords for guest Wi-Fi. That in itself compromises security. So the ability to offer unique passwords that expire at preset times lets the operators of the wireless network know who has access to their network and for how long. That level of control creates deeper levels of guest wireless security and performance. They can control bandwidth-heavy applications. They can control users. They can look for suspicious activity. And this isn't some sort of thing of spying on you. It's this whole, what I consider to be fiduciary responsibility to monitor what's going on and to look for bad doo-doo and then deal with it proactively. And in their survey, WatchGuard did this huge survey, they found that 51% of global hospitality organizations do not monitor guest networks for suspect applications, malware, or malicious activities. 51%. This is why guest Wi-Fi is oftentimes portrayed as the Wild West. They say 62% do not monitor guest activity with regards to bandwidth-intensive applications. 48% do not use policy mapping or any data visualization tools to monitor anything. And the lapse of guest internet and Wi-Fi network visibility and controls has a significant impact on guest network performance as well as security implications. Now, the last tidbit here is that WatchGuard's latest fireware, I think it was with 11.9.4, they're currently on 11.10 beta, has phenomenal tools now for people who are operating guest Wi-Fi. They've always had phenomenal tools for defense in depth, for the ability to lock down naughty things from happening. You really have to have advanced persistent threat blocking capabilities as well. So I hope this has been instructive, and certainly if you have questions, do send me an email to breakfastbites@gmail.com.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters.